On this episode of Baseball Barbacast, we celebrate what might have been the single greatest baseball performance in a day in the history of the sport. Oh, wait, it definitely freaking was. Shohei Ohtani pushing the Los Angeles Dodgers into the World Series with a 3-home run, 6-inning pitch. What a thing that is. Also, by the way, Game 7 is going to happen. By the time you're listening to this, it's today. Jays Mariners will review games 5 and games 6 and to talk about game 7. And then like a little bit of Tony Vitello chat at the end for the real ball knowers out there. Buckle up. Hello and welcome to Baseball Barbacast, the only baseball podcast in the world recording from the world's largest kaleidoscope. I'm Jake Mintz. That's Jordan Schusterman. I officiated a wedding tonight, and I know that that sounds like a bit. Oh, yeah, I'm at the world's largest kaleidoscope. So instead of talking about Shohei Ohtani's greatest baseball feat of all time and a game 6 in the ALCS that will give us a game 7, I think we just do kaleidoscope chat for this pod.
You know, we don't... If you wonder how we prepare for these podcasts, and you know, you wonder, oh, does Jordan know what Jake's going to say when the podcast starts? Is he going to know the open? Even by our standards of not knowing what you're going to say, this one has really thrown me, and not just because we are recording this after midnight local time. It is good to see you, my friend. The Blue Jays and Mariners are going to play a Game 7, but because they're going to play a Game 7 and because the Mariners are not going to the World Series, we are going to begin with Shohei Ohtani.
So, there has been a debate, a conversation, a talking point, a prompt. Was Ohtani's performance the single greatest baseball day ever? And in trying to rack the history books of my brain to think of anything else, I realized quickly that it was a false errand, that it was a pointless endeavor, that the only person to ever come remotely close to what Ohtani did the other day was Ohtani. Okay, was the man himself. And he has never done anything like this on a stage this grand. Neither of us were in the building. But like watching the highlights back and following along with the game, with each home run, so he hit three of them. Each home run was just like, he did it again. It was one of the most remarkable things I did not see. Obviously, I watched it all back. Jordan, how did you take this in? And is it even worth talking about whether or not this is the greatest performance of all time?
It is. And I am going to say that. And normally, it's funny because I am usually the
you
one.
You hate hyperbole. That,
yeah, I'm the one that's usually trying to slow down Jake Mintz as he is, you know, ramping up and rearing back to unleash a, this is the greatest, blah, blah, blah. This means the most, blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, all right, let's relax. We're not that old. We've only seen so much ball. I don't feel like I need to qualify this. And while I was not there, in fact, one of the weirdest things about this and why I will also remember it so vividly is because of what I was watching at the exact same time, which was this Mariners epic eighth inning, which we will talk about a little bit later on. Ohtani's first home run was, I think, 90 seconds after Cal Raleigh's game-tying homer. So I'm already in the Seattle press box just like processing the historical significance of what's happening right in front of me. And then I understand that Ohtani is on the mound and like trying to send the Dodgers back to the World Series. And once Ohtani hits the first home run, immediately I'm just like recognizing the significance of that, even watching it on my phone on mute. And just, it was so, so much to process. Like, think about what it would take to upstage what the Mariners did in that game 5. And that's exactly what happened. That is every bit what happened. But we'll get to that game five later, and let's keep the focus on Shohei, because I think, as you mentioned, the only guy that's made us feel this way before is him, right?
Yep.
And people were quick to bring up his game last season in Miami when he goes 6-for-6 with 10 RBIs and 3 homers and 2 doubles and gets to 50-50. And this is so much cooler than that. Like, not even he was, not only did he get his right, the last homer was off a position player. It was in Miami. It was the regular season. It was on the road at all. Forget, I'm not just dunking on, yep, Lone Depot. For him to do this in this, they're only up 3-0. To do it in front of the Dodgers fans. Remember, the Dodgers had to wait a whole year to see Ohtani do the two-way thing. And he did it. He sure did it.
Do you know what was also different about this game and that game is that he pitched in this one. Okay.
It would have been one thing
if Ohtani was like okay on the mound the other night and hit 3 home runs. Like if he had gone 4 2/3 and allowed 3 and went yard 3 times and the Dodgers won 7-2. That doesn't make math sense, but you get my point. We would have sat here today and been like, that was incredible. But then he dominated on the mound, too. Like, he was sublime. He was unbelievable. He struck out the side of the first inning after walking the leadoff guy. And then from that point on, it was like, they have zero chance. The Brewers are done. They have there's no chance. I mean, I kind of felt that way heading into it. The one thing I want to bring up with Ohtani that I think is relevant is, like, there leading up to this start had been questions, legitimate questions, about his ability to hit when he pitches, right? I had a stat that I pulled earlier in this postseason. I don't have the exact number, but I think his overall OPS when he pitches was around 830-ish, right, this season. Now, granted, it's not that many starts, but that number was even worse when you take out his first two starts where he only pitched the first inning. And again, 830 OPS every team would want that guy immediately, but it is below Ohtani's standards. And as we celebrate this guy who is doing these two things at the same time, and you start to notice, like, hey, the offense is dipping. That's notable. And then as the questions come in, he got a little pissy in the press conference the other day. Did you see this? He was like as pissy as this guy can get, to be fair. But he was basically like, I'm not worried. This is not a concern. Like, whatever. And then he immediately was like, no, this is not a concern. And I think you could see it on his face as he rounded the bases. So he goes out in the first inning. It was like 4:27. And it's like, okay, everyone shut up. But then when he hits the one out of the stadium that doinks off the roof, and his expression around the bases doesn't change. Usually he's a very like happy-go-lucky home run hitter. Like he's not demonstrative like Josh Naylor, right? Or like almost Naylor's more like performatively, like this is just business. Like Ohtani doesn't usually do that, but he didn't smile as he routed the bases after the second homer. And to me, that just was like, this guy was playing with a little bit of an edge tonight. And it came out. And he was basically just telling all of us to shut up.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's worth remembering that he did homer twice in the first game against the Reds. But after
it
that...
It felt like a scrimmage.
NL Central disrespect just continues anyway, 4-for-33 in the 8 games. Between his 2 homers against the Reds and with 14 strikeouts and, what he did the other day. And I think that you're right. I think that that's a fair assessment of kind of what he looked like. But, going back to his kind of response to questions about his ability to do both things, like that is the whole, it is truly his identity to a point that it is so personal.
Yeah.
And that is why I think he's taking the most pleasure, personal satisfaction in showing everyone that he can do this at this level, because that's the whole point. That is like his whole purpose from the beginning. And so he's, but he already has proved us wrong over and over and over and over for sure. And so I think that's also part of what makes this so cool, is that is the fact that he still even feels like, and the fact that us stupid media people are even putting him in the position to prove us wrong again, right? Like, that alone feels absurd considering what we've seen this guy do. And yet I'm kind of glad we started to doubt him for no good reason, so that he could give us the greatest game of all time. And by the way, the stat line is the stat line, but these three home runs, I mean, let's just not just gloss over the fact that he hit three home runs, because if he hits a couple of them, a couple wall scrapers, is this still statistically the greatest game of all time? Yeah. But is it as memorable? No. I mean, the first homer almost leaves the stadium. And
it's the least impressive.
And it's the least, right. And it is the least impressive. The third one is a homer that we've seen from him many times. And it is so
that only he can do.
It's like he's really the only guy. Like, Soto, kind of, obviously Soto has maybe the best opposite field power, but it's really just them that can take a fastball like that and go, what is it, 420 to left center. I mean, I guess that last one, right, it was only for 427. So, you know, shame on him. But
so the Soto one is a little different, because for Soto, it's like he can take an elevated pitch and do that. Mm-hmm. That's like up and away. For Shohei, it's like the ball's down and in, right? It's down
what,
and in.
99?
And he's just able to, at 99, down and in. And he's able to like effectively scoop it, like fight it off 427 to the backside. And it really was a remarkable thing. And when you look at the responses in the dugout, you saw this after the second one and the third one, right? Like, the Dodgers have some of the best baseball players in the world. They're in the World Series again, which, by the way, I literally haven't even said that. They're in the World Series again because they have a roster full of great players. Yeah. And to watch those players watch Ohtani, to see the awe on their faces, that they understand what they're witnessing is special, is singular, is unique, is generational. That is the appreciation that's how I take it in. Because, like, you know, Ellie De La Cruz hits a ball for 35 and like dudes in the dugout are like, wow, that was pretty wild. But like what Ohtani did, Freddie Freeman, who had the single most defining moment of last year's postseason, looking like a 3-year-old in the dugout when Shohei goes yard for the third time. Like, what? Like, what? What?
Yeah. He also throws 100 pitches for the first time since...
I could do that.
Like, in 2+ years. He certainly hasn't done that this year. And listen, obviously, a big part of this series, which is very much over, is the Brewers' offense scoring exactly one run in all four games.
A series has never been more over.
But that said, you know...
Jordan,
this
series is
actually
Shover.
Strike out 10 guys. It's Shover from the rip. I think that is a good way to put it. It is what he is making the other best players in the world think and feel is yeah. really what sums it up. I'm sure he's been looking forward to this since he was not coming anywhere close to the postseason with the Angels, and now here we are.
Yes. And while he had moments in last year's postseason, there really wasn't a defining one.
Yeah, I was thinking about that.
I think he like...
I was thinking about that.
You know, honestly, the fact that nothing sticks out in my mind right now is indicative enough that this is the thing. Like, this is the Shohei Ohtani postseason moment. He may have more. You know, he will have more. He's on the Dodgers for 8 more seasons, and they'll probably be in October every year. But, like, it wasn't a fair narrative, but, like, you could make a jokey point that the Dodgers were dragging Ohtani to the World Series through the playoffs. You know, like, I think if you put, like, 8 beers into an uncle, he could make that point. Right? But, like, that's dead. Like, that's gone now. Like, that, you can't say that. Like, we made it like 10 minutes into the show without even saying the words. The Los Angeles Dodgers are going to the World Series. One, because duh. two, because of what Ohtani accomplished.
Yeah. So last year, just looking at it, he did have three homers last postseason. He homered, I think the biggest one was in that first game of the postseason against the Padres. He had two against the Mets, but those were both in blowouts in New York. So yeah, I mean, he, and then in the World Series, he was relatively quiet. Remember, he has that weird injury sliding, and like that was a whole, you know, story yeah. too. But to have a game like this too, and it is funny because clearly he's capable of doing it physically, but he does look pretty tired by the end. Like he looks like he is sweating more, like on the days that he's pitching. Like when he came up for that last home run, like he did look like a little more weary, and he, you know, does what we
this reminds me of like anyway. when I did the bike ride and I would like see you at the end of a really long day and you'd be like, you look exhausted. And I'm like, yeah, dude, like I just biked 96 miles. Like I'm cooked. It's like, I hope he looks tired, you know?
I know.
Like, I know. I hope he left it all out there.
That's like the only human part about it is that he looks like he just threw 100 pitches and hit three home runs, a combined 1,300 feet or whatever. So yeah, I mean, I don't know, man. It is, and I will say too, from the perspective of the Blue Jays and Mariners people, that's people around the team, that's media, that's the whole thing. Just kind of like observing this from afar is also hilarious because everyone's just like, oh man, that's going to be a real treat dealing with that team.
And it's also these two teams. I mean, this is a whole other angle, but like the two teams waiting for Shohei are really the two teams that feel the most slighted that they never got him.
In some ways.
The Mariners, because of Ichiro and the Japanese connection in Seattle, we assumed that the Mariners had a real chance in that first run. Being an AL team, having a DH, They assumed it too. The video of friend of the program, Mina Kimes, losing her mind. Like, it just felt like that's where Shohei was going. And when he wasn't, there was a loss. And then the second time around, that was Toronto, right? They were the team that thought they had a chance. He's on the plane. He's not on the plane. Gets off the plane. Never was on the plane. And now he's on the Dodgers. So that's a nice little, you know, thing to keep in the back of your head.
Hey.
Before we take a break. Hey. Yeah?
Blue Jays win tomorrow. He'll be on that plane to Toronto.
Getting on a plane. He'll be on that plane. He'll be on one of the two Dodger planes. The Los Angeles Dodgers are going back to the World Series. I feel so stupid that we didn't pick them. I feel so stupid that I even jokingly picked the Reds to beat them. This was inevitable all along. We're all idiots. We should be humbler. They're the best team. Does the money help? Yeah, the money helps. The money also helped the Mets, and they're on vacation. And I think that the Dodgers, we say this on the show all the time, you have to hold multiple things in your head simultaneously. Do the Dodgers have a competitive advantage because they have more money than everybody else? Of course. Is what they are doing impressive and unbelievable and an accomplishment for the ages? Absolutely. Both of those things are true. We can debate about what this means for the sport later. Dave Roberts apparently wants us to talk about it now after they won, and he grabbed the microphone and said, four more wins till we ruin baseball. Dave, when you're sitting on your couch in May of 2027, maybe you won't look too brightly upon that choice of words. I will feel the same. However, we can litigate all that down the road in the winter. When there's nothing else to talk about, I think just for now, holy crap, here are the Dodgers again. And they get to play a team that's going to go seven, dude. Like, that's another big advantage. They only went four.
Yes, very good point. Quickly, a farewell to the Brewers. This was unfortunate.
So
I don't know.
Can I be a bummer?
Really? I mean, it's not like I was about to bring some positive vibes. So yeah, if you want to really just bring it home.
Maybe this isn't fair because this is against two thoughts at the same time. I saw someone tweet like, you know, the way this season ended doesn't change what this Brewers team was. And like, I kind of think it does just because of how meek of a showing this was. Like, I don't think they were frauds all along. Like, I think this was a good ball club. You have to be good to win that many games. But at no point, like, the people who are like, this team is not built to win in October, those people, they look really smart right now. And that's a bummer, because that's not the world I want to live in. I want to live in the world where, like, you know, Caleb Durbin can single-handedly carry the Brewers to the World Series. Like, that sounds really fun. But I do think it does dampen the whole thing. Is that too harsh, yeah, do you think? It was just so, like, on the biggest stage, like, with a chance to show what this team was all about, they did not do that. Flat out.
Yeah. I mean, again, this is getting ahead of ourselves, but the best thing that could happen for the Brewers is that the Dodgers absolutely kick crap out of whoever comes out of the AL, right? That's the only thing that's going to make them feel any better. Because otherwise, and even that is not much of a consolation. But I think you would need to be viewing it more of the lens through the Dodgers than that there's something wrong, inherently wrong with the Brewers.
Oh, no, that's not what I'm saying. I'm not saying there's anything wrong with the Brewers. I'm just saying that, like, they didn't show up. Like, the offense just did not show up. And again, they're better than I am, and who am I to throw stones? I can't hit either. But, like, this wasn't how it was supposed to go for them. And it sucks because, boy, were they electric. Were they electric and inspiring and unique and different? This was a great team. This was just a freaking circus show that I think for most of the season, like, made people believe. And I am just really bummed that that belief in the end, not that it was misplaced, but it wasn't fulfilled. And it wasn't even close, right? You can't look back on the series and be like, you know, if this goes like this and that goes like that, like, maybe the talent gap was just so monumental that you look back and you're like, man, they didn't have a shot. They didn't have a shot from the jump.
Yep. I think that is a fair way to say it. Although I am looking at this box score and I'm seeing that Chad Patrick, besides allowing a home run that left the stadium, was awesome. 4 innings, 1, that was the only hit, only base runner, 5 strikeouts. Chad Patrick, finishing on a good note. Are you going to be in that highlight forever? Yes, you are. But I'm excited about Chad Patrick entering 2026. Brewers fans, you can hang your hat on that. All right, we're going to take a break. When we return, let's talk about the Mariners and the Blue Jays. We'll be right back. Baseball Barbecues.
Welcome back to Baseball Barbacast. Let's fly over to the American League, where a whole lot has happened since we last spoke. This is the thing, right? Like, we record on a Thursday night or a Friday morning, and then the last two Fridays, we have had two of the most preposterous games in recent postseason memory. Probably the two of the wildest games in Seattle Mariners history, that's for sure. The first one was the 15-inning jamboree, and this past Friday was the Gino freaking Suarez game. By this point, you know all about it. Mariners down 1, heading into the 8th inning, facing an embarrassing proposition. The idea of dropping all 3 games at home and having to head back to Toronto to take 2 in the Rogers Center. Cal Raleigh leads off with a solo shot to tie it. A moon scraper. The roof felt like it was in play. It lands just a foot beyond the wall in left field to tie things up. Walk, pitching change, hit by pitch, base loaded, no outs. Gino Suarez lofts one to the opposite field, clears the wall. Pandemonium. Jordan Schusterman, you were in the building for this. Just what was it like, man? What was it like, man?
I mean, listen, Mariners fans were waiting for that for 26 innings or whatever. Games 3 and 4, not a whole lot to cheer about. And the start of this game, it wasn't looking particularly inspiring either. The decision to go to Brendan Little was certainly one that has been probably already forgotten to some degree by Blue Jays fans after their Game 6 win. But people were pretty shocked that he didn't just go to Hoffman to try and close out that game. And listen, Brendan Little's been very bad recently, but he's allowed 2 home runs all season. Walking guys is what he does, and that part was less surprising, but it allowed the Mariners to really, really get something going. And Sir Anthony comes in and immediately plunks Randy. And there's the moment for Gino, the moment that he's been thinking about for years. This is a dude with over, what, like 350 home runs in his career or almost. But he had never, he homered earlier in this game. That was how they opened the scoring. You know, Gino's now been on a couple postseason runs with the Mariners. He had not homered at home. He had homered in Houston in 22. He had homered earlier in the series last round against in Detroit. But for a guy that, of course, has this connection with the fans, is one of the most lovable players from a fan perspective and certainly teammates from, you know, an internal perspective. I mean, this was the whole thing. And as Mitch Garver told me, it is a swing he has been taking for the last decade. He is another one where that power is just, that is what all fields power looks like. And not easy to go Oppo, no doubter, in Seattle. And that's exactly what he did. And that's like, it's the loudest I've ever heard a stadium. And I've seen some cool stuff. The roof being close certainly helped, but it was amazing. It was, I'm so glad for the Mariners fans who have been watching this team for a whole lot longer than I have, that they got to have that moment. And, you know, whatever happens in game seven, that is a game that will live on forever. And Gino is the easiest person in the world to want that to happen too. So it was incredible
for him specifically. I think a lot about just how many swings that dude has taken in his life, right? Just the number of times he has picked up a baseball bat and swung it at a baseball. So he is 22nd in baseball with 6,627 career plate appearances. That is 22nd among active players. I have to look through this to see if he is number one without a World Series appearance. Mike Trout is ahead of him, unfortunately. And I think it's Mike Trout, it's Christian Yelich, and that's it. Okay.
Really? So like, I'm not looking at the list, but sure. Okay. It's rare, but I'd say it's a good point.
Nolan Arenado, Mike Trout, I believe, Yelich, and that's the list. So like, the reason I bring that up is just how many times this guy has swung a bat, and like, for what? What are you doing this for? You're chasing this moment. I mean, you're doing it to make millions of dollars and have a big house and send your grandkids to private school, whatever, but like, you're doing it so that you can get that adrenaline rush and so that you can black out while you're on the bases and so that your name rings out forever in a city that loves you. And Gino will have that no matter what. I think something that you said before the playoffs is kind of stuck with me, which is if the Mariners lose in the ALDS, the Tigers this season will be a failure. And, you know, I think that was an interesting thing to say, and I understand why you were saying it, and I get it. And now I've reached a point where it's maybe a loser mentality, but like, if the Mariners lose game seven tomorrow, and we'll talk about game six in a second, if they lose game seven tomorrow, I think the prevailing feeling in Seattle will be sad, not mad. It will be bummed, not angry. And I think if they had lost to the Tigers, it would have been much angrier. It would have been more fury. And because they got that moment, like, that moment happened and you can't take it away, and obviously it'll have more significance if they go into the World Series and they beat the Dodgers, blah, 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 right? Like, yes. But this Mariners team has gotten further than any Mariners team has ever gotten in the history of the franchise, and they got there because of a magical inning and a magical swing from a beloved figure. And even if George Kirby goes out there tomorrow and is a pitching machine, that lives on forever.
Yeah, I mean, right. How Game 7 goes definitely makes a difference. And I never want to speak on behalf of fan bases, but I certainly agree with the sentiment that you just shared. But yeah, about Gino, I mean, it's a great point. Just looking at this list, you did definitely leave out some two pretty big ones at the top, but he's pretty high on there. I mean, Andrew McCutchen. You think
Andrew McCutchen's literally number one.
Anywhere close to a World Series, he's hasn't gotten all that close. And then Goldschmidt, too, I believe, has never played in a World Series.
You know what? So, I just assumed he was there last year with the Yankees.
No, that is not the case. That was Mr. Anthony Rizzo. Anyway, but the point is that it still holds that like Gino's been doing this for a long time, and if you want to just make it more specific about hitting home runs, right? How many home runs has he hit that have been cool, but a fraction of what that must feel like. So, it was amazing. Glad I was there. Very cool. Obviously sets up the opportunity for the Mariners to go to the World Series for the first time ever. Got to come back East, do it in Toronto where they looked fantastic in games 1 and 2. And instead they play probably one of their worst games of the season. I would say maybe the worst game of the season by some measures it was. First time they've made 3 errors in a game all season. So that was cool. They grounded into double plays in 3 consecutive innings. Two with the bases loaded. You had Cal, JP, Julio. And the Blue Jays just, it was only 6-2. So it's not like it was a blowout. But this was pretty decisive. I mean, the Blue Jays looked way better. Vlad Jr. is really I really just want to focus on 2 things because, listen, folks, we got Game 7 coming up in however many hours, and that's what matters the most for both of these teams. Even the Blue Jays are not going to bother to, you know, linger on this because it's not going to matter in however many hours. But let's just do it again. Vlad Jr., here's your stat here. I'm going to throw this in my story. So he gets robbed by Gino early in the game, 116-mile-an-hour ground up. Hardest hit ball. To end the inning. That was a huge, stop to kind of stop the bleeding there for Seattle. He's like, all right, fine. You know, that'll help my ex-Woba, but it's not going to help my
ex-Woba flies forever. Ex-Woba
or does it just help his heart hit rate? Anyway, whatever. Point is, doesn't get the result there. And then he comes up later and he's like, I got you. 6th homer of the postseason. Here are the 2 stats. Here's your 2 Vlad Jr. stats for tonight, okay? First thing is that he ties Joe Carter and Jose Bautista for most home runs by a Blue Jay in the postseason ever. Not in
those
one season.
Those are the right guys
in
to
a career. In a career. In a career.
In a career. Now,
so Joe Carter did it over 3 postseason runs. Jose Bautista, who was in the house 45th birthday throughout the first pitch, he did it in 2 postseason runs in 15 and 16. Vlad, of course, all of these have come this year. Which brings us to our second fun fact, Jake Mintz. Mr. Guerrero's OPS this postseason, are you aware of what it is now after his latest 2-hit game with a hit by pitch?
Does it start with a 2?
No, it doesn't start with a 2. Okay. It is 15-32.
No way, dude.
15-32. And Jake Mintz, do you know where that ranks all time? Minimum 40 plate appearances in postseason history. Obviously, he has more games to play, maybe 1, maybe 5, maybe 8, whatever.
I'll say, behind Randy.
So Randy is
he just had
12th
so many
on
games.
This list. The problem with Randy, no, again, single, yeah, he played 20 games. And so, like, Randy is 12th. Again, this is minimum 40 plate appearances in a postseason.
Oh, isn't Randy there
had,
that dude?
Randy had 86 plate appearances. So, like, it ended up only being 1273 in 2020, which ranks 12th.
Okay.
So it is well above that.
Name like Bullet Joe something high on that list.
I prop maybe, but I'm not seeing it on the stat head search I'm doing.
All right,
right
you
now.
Tell me then.
There are only 2 players that are above Vlad Jr.
Okay,
he passed 1989 Ricky Henderson tonight, and so now he is only bested by 2004 Carlos Beltran, which. He had a nice little month there, if you recall. And Barry Bonds in 2002.
Barry Bonds.
And the craziest part, Bonds 1559, Beltran 1557, Vlad, as I mentioned, 1532, within striking distance somehow. And Barry Bonds drew 27 walks in the 2002 postseason. So, Vlad only has, I think, 6 walks and 2 strikeouts. But
I mean,
the point is, we're watching one of the greatest postseasons of all time. That's what's happening.
I know you were there. Did you see the clip of Hazel May asking him, like talking to him on the field?
I saw that right before.
Oh, go watch it, folks, if you haven't. It's just him understanding the moment, the gravity of it all, and what it means, and him to stay and be there, and to live in Canada, and to be there, like to be the guy, dude. And like, he has grown into it in such an impressive way. Where I when you, that's your name, when your name is Vladimir Guerrero Jr., dude, like things are expected.
I was gonna say,
of you.
This was my last part about this, because, and this is, you're hitting on it right here. Team DR is rooting for Vladdy pretty hard here. Obviously, the Mariners have, you know, their fair share of Dominicans as well. But Vlad is, and by the way, I got my first glimpse. I don't know if you saw in games one and two, or I guess last round. Did you see the Guerrero squad rolling deep in the tunnel?
No.
I'm 90% sure that Gabby was there, and like, there's a lot of it's like, that's the whole squad right there. So, but it is a royal baseball family in a very important baseball country.
This has not always come easy to him, sure. Right? The expectations, it's a lot to carry, and he has had to carry it since he was 19.
Yeah.
And he has grown in earlier than that. And like, what this guy is now, still only 26. Some guys get the money and they go to the mall and they buy some nice stuff and they eat a lot of nice meals and they put on the pounds and they coast. And Vladdy has done the opposite. He has locked the hell in. It is a joy to watch. And I am so happy for this guy. And like, it's so cool, dude. So the Jays win tonight. Yeah. They win 6-2. Logan Gilbert, not good. The splitter he left up to Barger in the first inning was a bad pitch. Savage was not as dominant as we have seen him. More of a bend, not break. Obviously, those three double plays help quite a bit. And then the other main storyline from tonight is Toronto's bullpen, right? Locking it down. Scoreless innings in the 7th, 8th, and 9th. Jeff Hoffman tossing the final six outs. Jeff Hoffman, fascinating character for me. You know, they sign him. Any team that gives a closer big money, right? You're making a real gamble. You're making a risk. You're risking it. And he was the best reliever I'd ever seen in April. He was unbelievable in April. And then the wheels fell off. And he was just pretty bad for the rest of the year. And they have gone back to him, right? They've stuck with this guy. And for him to go out there tonight and get six outs in game six, I mean, that was enormous. Fascinated to see what that means for tomorrow, if he's available after throwing the most pitches he's thrown all year. But tomorrow is for tomorrow, right? The Jays had to win tonight, and they got the job done. Any last thoughts on tonight before we pivot to game seven?
I would just say, well, of course, three double plays is incredibly timely and fortunate. Savage was really good. He, of course, had the run support where he could kind of settle in and attack guys. I think that helped. But the splitter was awesome. You know, he got 10 whiffs on it out of his 15, 7 strikeouts, you know, almost finishes 6 innings. And that's big, because that means Toronto only had to use 2 other pitchers in Varland and Hoffman. And to your point, as we think about game 7, I think, Hoffman throwing the most pitches he has all year. What does he look like tomorrow? We'll see. Varland, of course, has been used hard. Of course, they stayed away from Sir Anthony and Little after the Game 5 disaster. The Mariners get 2 more from Bizzardo. Brash was not great. Of course, don't use Munoz. They don't use Spire. So, I mean, here we go, man. We got Bieber and George Kirby. Kirby, who of course got torched last time, right? 8 runs allowed. And Bieber, who was, you know, struggled early and then really settled in. But in a game 7 like this, where you are going to pretty much have everybody available, now we're really looking at 2 managers who have had a lot of their moves questioned over the year. And then also, I mean, Schneider, more than just this year, and certainly just literally just happened in game 5. So this is, as with any game 7, the managers are in the spotlight, the starting pitchers are in the spotlight. And who's gonna get that big swing? How many guys are on base when one of these guys hits a home run? Because that's the thing about the Mariners offense right now, is like, they need guys to be on base when they hit the home run. And Josh Naylor homered tonight, but that was a solo shot. And they showed some life late But the rallies being squashed early by the double plays just kind of sucked the air out of their offense over and over and over.
So something to keep an eye on for tomorrow night is how long do these starters go? And the one advantage that I think the Mariners have in a game seven is that they effectively have an extra pitcher to use, and that's Brian Wu. So we might see Gausman tomorrow night, who started games 1 and 5 for Toronto. We might see Max Scherzer tomorrow night, who started game 4. Then the Mariners, right, they have Luis Castillo, who started game 4. And they have, who started game 1? Bryce Miller. But then they
Bryce
also
Miller
have Brian
for
Wu.
Sure.
Like, yeah. Brian, I mean, like, Wu is the one for me where it's like, yeah, how so much do they use him? He threw in game 5 or game 4?
He did throw in game 5. He allowed the run. Both runs or the go-ahead run earlier in that game. And he looked pretty good. He threw 2 innings and he said he's going to be available. So yeah, when it would be him over Bryce, over these other guys, like, I don't know, man. I mean, I think we're going
to
see some serious managerial button mashing.
Yes. And it's like, I would be pretty shocked if Kirby goes more than 3 tomorrow.
I mean,
you know,
it's so weird. Like, that might even be high. I agree. And yet, like, I don't know. It's kind of hard for me.
So
to like
here's what I'll say. If I'm the Mariners, I don't want a single human being facing Vlad twice. Like if the game's right. Close,
that's a
like,
good.
Oh,
way.
You
that's
already. Oh, Vlad already saw you. That's Vlad already saw you. You're next, and you can bridge. Like you can bridge between the bulk guys to have other dudes face Vlad. Like you probably don't want Vlad facing sure. Spire. You know, you probably don't want Vlad facing the other lefty, Caleb Ferguson. Who's you know.
Yeah.
But like you can mix and match it.
I think it's a good point, and we'll take a break here. I think, yeah, maybe just thinking about it is like, when do you send in the righties to face Vlad? Like, are you choosing to bring in Wu to face Vlad, especially if it's in the middle of an inning? Same thing with Miller, same thing like, or Brash, who, you know, struck him out in game 5, first time Vlad struck out swinging all postseason, but then he plunked him tonight trying to throw that same inside fastball. So, there's just Vlad is just he is
but the key is the whole key thing. The key for thing. Seattle is like he's gonna beat you. It's not even like, you know, people always say, oh, you can't let that guy beat you. But he's gonna beat you.
Yeah.
Our guy's gonna be on base when he beats you. Is it gonna be a double down the line where it doesn't score anyone, or is it gonna be a 3-run bomb? Even tonight, like he got him, but it was a solo shot, right? That's the key, I think. The one other thing I want to bring up before we move on is, like, if you take out that eighth inning in game 5, which you can't do because it was amazing, but if you take out that eighth inning, the Blue Jays have effectively dog walked the Mariners for 4 straight games. I know game 5 was close, but they've been in control of this series.
Sure.
Now.
Yeah.
Right. It has flipped. And I think that because of that, I'll take Toronto tomorrow night. Mm-hmm. I just think they're playing better right now.
Yeah.
But the Seattle's offense needs to show up. Like, that's the thing. And what do I know, right? What do I know?
And to that point, I will not make a prediction, but I will say this. What do they say when you get to game 7? What do they say? What do they say?
How about that? How about this game 7 we got?
No, they say anything can happen in game 7. Is that not true?
Anything can happen in a game 2. Anything can happen in May.
Anything can happen. Anything can happen on June 6th. All right, we're going to take a break. When we return, some words about Tony Vitello. And then we will say goodbye.
And now for something completely different. Normally during the playoffs, we like to keep things on the field. However, there is definitely something going on that we need to talk about. There are a bazillion managerial openings right now around Major League Baseball, and at no point did we seriously think that any of them would be filled by a college baseball coach. And that is what seems to be maybe potentially happening for the San Francisco Giants, who, according to reports from Ken Rosenthal and Britt Ciroli and Jeff Passan, are making significant headway towards hiring the head coach at the University of Tennessee, Tony Vitello. Now, why is this significant? Vitello would be the first college head coach to make the leap directly to an MLB manager's chair ever. Now, there have been coaches to managers to coach at the college level. Pat Murphy famously was at Arizona State. He was at Notre Dame. He's now in charge of the Brewers. But there was a 10-15 year gap between those two jobs, right? This would be unprecedented and would be shocking and might not happen. And if it does, we will talk about it in depth when it does. But we just need to explain to everybody that this is bananas, that it has even gotten this far. And that I know what happens in other sports and there's reasons why it doesn't happen in baseball. But this is not like the Giants are plucking just like a good college coach. Like, this dude is a character. A character.
Yeah. And I also think that, like, it's interesting to think about other sports and how you could be like, oh, well, this guy is going to come and bring in his system, his offense that dominated the Big 12, you know, in football or in basketball. And, like, how is that style going to work at the professional level? And I guess the system that Tony Vitello is running is a recruiting and development monster that Tennessee has become very, very quickly. This is, of course, a program that has had some, you know, big time names over the years, you know, the Todd Heltons of the world, but it was not until really the last five or so years that they became very quickly. I mean, they kind of just went, you know, 0 to 100. It was like, all right, they're getting good. Oh, okay, they're the best. They are maybe the best program. Oh,
they won the national championship.
Vitello's been a big part of that, and they won the national championship.
A big part of that. I mean, he's been the driving force of that. Yes. Like, he has single-handedly reoriented the baseball program at this university and made it one of the most relevant programs. Like, when I was in Omaha, the College World Series is here, and you talk to kids, they all want to go play Tennessee. When we were growing up, they all wanted to go play Vanderbilt. That has changed. This is the program. It's them and it's LSU. Right. And Vitello is very charismatic. He's high energy. He's in your face. He's rah-rah. He is, like, encouraging his teams to play with an edge that can really piss people off a lot of the time. And the reason that we don't see this a lot is because in college, if you're a college baseball coach, right, you have control over player personnel. You're picking the team. You're building the team. You're helping. You're, you know, recruiting. You're deciding who plays and who doesn't, who makes the team and who doesn't, who you're going to go get in the portal. You don't get that type of control as a big league manager. Not even close. That's the general manager's job. Whereas in football or basketball, you have way more say over personnel, right? If you're the head coach of the Bengals, like, you're not the GM, but, like, you're not the GM. You know what I mean? Like, whereas in baseball, there's a much bigger gap between those two things. And that's why this is so compelling, because Vitello would be giving up a ton of control to go and prove himself at this level, that to make a leap that has never really been done before. And I think that, you know, his ego, which is a powerful thing in this case, and not necessarily in a bad way, is a character here. Because the money still doesn't make sense to me, because Vitello is making $3 million a year in Knoxville, which is the equivalent of like $4.5-$5 million in San Francisco. And so the Giants are going to have to pay this guy who's never managed a game in the big leagues, never stepped foot in a big league dugout, pay him like one of the highest paid coaches in Major League Baseball. If they're willing to take that risk, Buster Posey can't stop cooking. I remain more like, not to doubt the reporting, I just can see a scenario where this is all leverage for Tony Vitello to get a bigger deal back home at Tennessee, and that next year he's not managing the Giants. That would not be surprising. It would not be shocking. But that we are even at this point is a fascinating development in our sport.
Yeah. And I think that's where we can kind of leave it now, because what is so amazing about this, if it happens, is there's like so many questions about just like the premise of any college coach making that leap. And then you add in this character in particular, the notion that like he would go from talking into a microphone 100 times a year to 500. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's so much about what a big league manager is, right? Is you're the voice. You're the kind of the tenor of the team. And that's a very different assignment for 3 months for a college team versus for 6+ for a professional team. And so I can't say that this is a good or a bad idea because it's just something I never really conceived of in this way, but it is something that I am glad is happening or at least being discussed, because even if it doesn't happen, Buster Posey just got a whole lot more interesting for the rest of this offseason, and he was already clearly going to be a main character. That's it for now. We will certainly have more news on that soon, so stay tuned there. But I'm going to go watch Game 7. First, I'm going to finish writing about Game 6, and then I'm going to go watch Game 7, and then I'm going to go home for like 5 minutes, and then we're going to go to the World Series, which is pretty cool.
I can make that work.
So we will see, and I will see you there, wherever that is. I'm looking forward to it. More pods to come this week, of course. But until then, thank you to Andrew Hartz and Ingrid Rosas for producing. Thank you, Jake Mintz, for making this happen from, what was it again? Tell me again where you are.
The world's largest kaleidoscope outside Phoenicia, New York.
There you go.
In the Catskills. Right.
Okay. So, I got some Googling to do once I'm done with my work tonight. So thank you for making this pod happen, and congratulations to the happy couple. And you can email us at baseballbarbecue@gmail.com, and we will talk to you all very soon. Bye-bye.